From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The investigative journalist Michael Isikoff has been working to uncover the little-known history of systemic gay persecution in the federal government, which went on for decades. He's produced a documentary short that lays out the story. It includes an edict from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to root out homosexuals working for the government. It includes an executive order signed by President Eisenhower that called homosexuality a perversion and a threat to national security. Scores of gay people were targeted by the same wave of hysteria that ruined the lives and careers of those accused of being communists. Today in the program, Isikoff is joining us to walk us through this story. This is not ancient history, he says, and elements of it are still very relevant today. Join us after the news.
Hello, podcast listener. This is Elaine Clark. I'm one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show's a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER's fall fund drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support the station, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. In his new documentary, the investigative journalist Michael Isikoff tells the story of Charles Francis, a Republican, a Texan, a supporter of George W. Bush, and a gay man. In fact, Francis came out to Bush, and he became an emissary for the gay community in the Bush campaign and the Bush presidency. Francis had hopes the administration would reach out to the LGBT community and even include openly gay people in high-ranking positions. But then the politics shifted. Bush strategists were looking to increase the campaign's standing among conservatives, and they used the fight against gay marriage as one of their tactical weapons. Isikoff reports that Charles Francis felt a sense of anguish and betrayal over that. And then it dawned on Francis that his experience fit into a larger historical picture of the treatment of gay people. And he began to dig and dig, and he uncovered a little-known period of history, an actual federal governmental program called the Sex Deviates Program, which targeted gays and lesbians. It collected intelligence in order to purge them from the federal ranks. Michael Isikoff is joining us today to take us through the history of the government's war on gay people. Isikoff is the chief investigative reporter for Yahoo News these days. He's previously reported, as many of you may know, for The Washington Post, for Newsweek, for NBC News. He reported and produced the 30-minute documentary I'm mentioning. It's called Uniquely Nasty, the U.S. Government's War on Gays. And he's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C., where he's based. And Michael Isikoff, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, great to be with you.
I should also mention you can find a link to the documentary and the reporting that accompanies all of this on our website. I'll give you details about that a little bit later. So, Michael Isikoff, how did you find the story? What was your first sense of this this period in history?
Well, you know, look, as an investigative reporter in Washington for many years, I've always been keenly interested in stories of government abuse, of national security, of secrets that the government has kept from us. And certainly I've had longstanding interest in the FBI and some of its history of abuses, COINTELPRO, the targeting of civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and political dissidents. And about a year or so ago, I happened to meet through a mutual friend this fascinating guy, Charles Francis, who you were describing before, the gay friend, once the gay friend of George W. Bush, who actually played a role in the 2000 campaign, had worked with Karl Rove to sort of gin up gay conservative votes for the Bush campaign during a period Bush was campaigning as a compassionate conservative. And he started telling me his personal story, his sense of betrayal by the Bush White House when in 2004 it began to use the same-sex marriage issue as a wedge issue to help the president get reelected. And then this whole effort that he launched to uncover what he calls the deleted history of the persecution of gays. And he began showing me some of the documents that he had uncovered, and I was literally blown away. You look at some of these, the FBI's Sex Deviates Program, ordered by J. Edgar Hoover in the darkest days of the Cold War, an edict to FBI agents all over the country to collect the names of gays and lesbians working for the federal government, to write up reports on them, find out what you can on them, and then to leak those names anonymously by blind memorandum, as Hoover says in the in one of these memos, to their employers for the purposes of getting them fired. And, you know, it's a stunning document that has only come to light very recently. In fact, I think we show this document for the first time in this film that people can see and read it for themselves. By the way, we got George Takei, the Star Trek guy, to be the voice of J. Edgar Hoover in the film. And, you know, there's some just fascinating little touches. Hoover orders agents to underline in green pencil the names of every sex deviant they learn about.
We're going to come back to that too, because I actually want to play some of those elements. I love hearing George Takei reading J. Edgar Hoover. Actually, it's kind of great.
Right. But just to conclude the point, I said this is a whole chapter of FBI abuses that the public knows almost nothing about, and in an era when we're very concerned about surveillance and government abuses and secrecy, I thought, you know, this is something that needs more attention. And that's what inspired me to want to make this film.
Yeah. Let's back up to that relationship between Charles Francis and George W. Bush.
Sure.
It's really interesting in a lot of ways. And some of the elements that you uncover in the story that Charles Francis tells you are kind of touching, you know, and you get a sense of why he felt so betrayed later, because in many ways, you mentioned that in 1998, Francis is, you know, he's well-connected. He's a sort of a friend of the Bush family. And he makes this really difficult decision to come out to George W. Bush. Would you talk a little bit about that moment? Because Mr. Bush responds in a kind of compassionate way.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have the letter, we show it in the film, in which Charles Francis effectively came out to the then governor. And he says, you know, within a couple of days after sending a letter, Governor Bush calls back and says, you know, I always knew you were gay. I just didn't know how to bring it up. But now that you have, I'm really glad you did. And I want to hear your ideas. And he embraces Charles Francis. There's no hint of discrimination or frowning or moral judgment on it at all. And he brings Charles Francis into his campaign. As I mentioned before, Charles Francis is soon meeting with Karl Rove and sort of plotting strategy, and he puts together this group known as the Austin 12 gay conservatives and Republicans who are assembled and come to meet with Bush in the 2000 campaign. And there are some fairly touching stories told during in the meeting, and we reflect in the film. And as Charles Francis says in the film, it was a historical moment, and a historical moment that's been forgotten.
Yeah. Let me play a moment from the film. President Bush meets with the Austin 12, and there's a nice moment that you have in the film where he says, you know, I was a better person for this meeting. I think it's good. And there's all this hope in the gay community, certainly among gay Republicans, that there might be even an openly gay appointee. And then I want to play this moment because this is former President Bush. And you, talking to Charles Francis, talking about this kind of historical moment. Here's a moment from Michael Isikoff's documentary film, Uniquely Nasty.
Well, I say to them, I welcome gay Americans into my campaign. We judge people based upon their heart and soul. That's what this campaign is about. And while we disagree on gay marriage, for example, we agree on a lot of other issues.
We see overnight tracking polls show that this meeting had an impact.
So this was a big deal.
It was a historical moment, and a historical moment that's been forgotten.
I wanted to ask you about that moment, because it seems like the country could have gone one way and then it shifts to another. After, as you say, the Bush administration decides to listen to conservatives and use gay marriage, for example, as a wedge issue. Do you think that was, in terms of it being an historical moment, that this moment in American politics, as opposed to going the way it did, could have gone another, if you know what I mean?
You know, it's always possible to sort of, you know, go back and play the what ifs. But, you know, if you look at what happened, you know, Charles, obviously there was tension from the beginning, and we reflect this in the film, because
sure.
There is the religious right. There's the hard core conservative values base that it was not open and embracing of gays and certainly not of the gay lifestyle. But that Bush really was not a part of that.
Right.
And even into the early days of the administration, Bush does name openly gay appointees. His first aide czar, Scott Everts, was actually a member of the Austin 12. And Charles Francis is feeling pretty upbeat about what he's done. But then you come to 2004 and you take a look back at what was happening then, and Bush was facing a really tough re-election battle. Remember, the Iraq War had gone south, Abu Ghraib, the 9/11 Commission laid out a lot of the opportunities missed Bush might have and the warnings that Bush had prior to 9/11. And it was looking like a really difficult uphill re-election fight.
Yeah.
And at that time, the gay marriage issue, same-sex marriage issue, was percolating. And there was a Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling that that embraced gay marriage and legalized in the state of Massachusetts. So Bush needs something to – and his campaign strategist needed something to rile up, to energize his base.
Yeah.
And one of the first things he does, and we show this in the film, is he comes out for a constitutional amendment on banning gay marriage,
right,
declaring that marriage is between a man and a woman. That's a blow to Charles Francis. And then you had all those same-sex marriage initiatives that were on the ballot in 2004, and the Bush campaign was embracing them. This was a way, and we show Barney Frank in the movie, the former Democratic congressman, talking about how this was a way to get out the vote. So in some ways, it was, cynical, but politics is often cynical.
Sure.
I don't know that it reflected a real change of heart in George W. Bush. It was just a matter of you got to do what you got to do to win re-election. And this was an issue that in some ways got handed to them, and then they chose to exploit it.
Yeah.
It was devastating to Charles Francis. He really did. He talks about in the film how he felt that he had been thrown overboard.
Yeah, sense of anguish. And, he said,
and basically broke with Bush, broke with the White House, left the Republican Party, and launched this new mission to uncover the history of the persecution of gays by the United States government.
You ask him early in the film, what was the most shocking thing he found? Talk about what he said.
Thousands of government files about gays and lesbians who were denied employment, who were fired, who had their lives ruined, their careers shattered. You see some of the documents and you hear some of these stories, and they are quite chilling.
The story is centered really in many ways in the 1950s. At least this is where it kind of kicks in. And give us some context for this time, because there, of course, is this real fear about communism. You have people like, you know, Richard Nixon and obviously Joseph McCarthy exposing communists in government. But I guess what a lot of people didn't realize, or most of us didn't know, is that homosexuality was also among these fears, I guess.
It was very much part of the mix. That if you were gay, you were a security risk. You were susceptible to blackmail by Soviet agents. So during the McCarthy era, you know, Joe McCarthy tried really hard to root out communists in government. You know, the most historians will tell you he really didn't find any. Not that they weren't there, but Joe McCarthy actually didn't find any. But what he did find was other security risks, gays, and there were purges from the ranks of the State Department and other national security agencies that was widely reported at the time. We show some of the headlines, you know, 131 security risks fired from the State Department. Those are gays. Those are people who the State Department security people identified as engaging or having engaged or suspected of having been engaged in same-sex conduct. There was actually this executive order signed by President Eisenhower in March of 1953 that declares sexual perversion a threat to national security, and that what that basically meant translated into actual government action is you could not get a security clearance if you were gay or suspected of being gay. If you had one, you'd lose it and you'd lose your job.
I'm trying to get a sense of what was the actual logic for all of this? Because one of the things you mentioned in the film, one of your sources who's written actually a book about all of this, says there was never really any evidence that communists were blackmailing gay people in the United States government. I guess it was just hysteria. It didn't make any logical sense in a lot of ways.
I think, look, this was a period of hysteria, of fear, of paranoia. It was the height of the Cold War. People were concerned about the Soviet threat. That was a bipartisan phenomenon.
Right.
If it was argued and by and large the government accepted this and the public accepted this, that because the shame of homosexuality was so great and so onerous that you would be susceptible to blackmail if you were gay.
I want to come back to that memo that you were talking about earlier, because this will give us a chance to hear from George Takei reading J. Edgar Hoover. Charles Francis, as you say, finds this critical document that helps him, you know, to make his case. And it's a document, as you say, that you really are showing in the film for the first time. Let me play. Maybe you can set this up for us. This is J. Edgar Hoover, and he's essentially giving this memo, this edict for people to rat out gay people in their departments, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, look, this is what's so shocking when you read it is this is the director of the FBI, the chief law enforcement officer in the country, ordering his agents to target what he calls sex deviants. And he's very meticulous. You see the sort of bureaucratic mentality. Hoover was the consummate bureaucrat, and he's methodical. It's sweeping. There are specific directives about how agents are to go about doing this. And we show that, and we show how it worked in the film.
Upon the receipt of an allegation that a present or former employee of any branch of the United States government is a sex deviant, such information in all cases should be disseminated. Each supervisor will be held personally responsible to underline in green pencil the names of individuals who are alleged to be sex deviants. Very truly yours, John Edgar Hoover.
Where did you find that memo? Where was this?
Well, this is, I mean, Charles Francis has filed multiple Freedom of Information Act requests across the government. And, you know, one of the interesting things is one of the reasons that we know very little about this sex deviance program, which, by the way, went on right up until the 1970s. So more than a quarter of a century, over 300,000 files were collected by the FBI about the sex lives of American citizens. Those files were destroyed. And we can get to that. There's a sort of interesting reason and moment. They were destroyed in the late 70s when the FBI was concerned that due to the Freedom of Information Act, the public and historians would learn a lot more about what it was doing. So they destroyed the files. And so most of the records of this sex deviance program were deleted. And as a result, so very little is known about it that you see barely a mention of it in most histories of the FBI and biographies of Hoover. But somehow a couple of these Hoover memos survived because they were distributed in other places. And this one, the green pencil memo, is one of them. And again, I was talking before about Hoover as the consummate bureaucrat. I love that sort of each agent will be held personally responsible to underline in green pencils the names of sex deviants. If you're a lowly FBI agent out in Salt Lake or Dubuque or wherever, right, and you get that order from the FBI director, you will be held personally responsible to do this. You do it.
What would happen, Michael Isikoff, if this were in the 1950s or 60s and you were exposed as gay? What would happen to you?
Well, most likely you would be, if you were working for the federal government, you would be fired.
Yeah.
It was pretty much accepted. Now, I was going to talk about this a little later, but since you brought it up, it is interesting that Eisenhower executive order related to security.
Right.
And so at that point in time, if you were gay, you couldn't get a security clearance. You couldn't work in a national security job. But over time, this morphed into something broader under the Civil Service Commission. And this was a bipartisan phenomenon. The chief player is a guy named John Macy, who was a Kennedy appointee who served under Lyndon Johnson. And the standards morphed into, if you were gay, you were not suitable for federal employment. You would be disruptive to the federal workforce. So even if you weren't working in a national security job, you would still be fired. Maybe we could talk about this later, but one of the fascinating guys in the film is
Charlie Baker.
Yeah. was a lowly clerk typist at the National Bureau of Standards, and he gets fired when the government discovers.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get back from a break. It's another extraordinary moment from the documentary that Michael Isikoff has created. His reporting is amazing here. One of the really explosive stories is the story of Lester Hunt, a senator from Wyoming. And we'll talk about the details of that when we get back from a break. Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News, reported and produced the 30-minute documentary Uniquely Nasty, the U.S. Government's War on Gays, for Yahoo's documentary series Viewfinder. We have links to all of this on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a while. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a powerful new documentary, the investigative journalist Michael Isikoff explores a dark and little-known chapter in America's recent political history. For decades, the federal government systematically persecuted and targeted gays and lesbians. They collected intelligence in order to purge them from the federal ranks. And this went on for decades. its painful legacy still lives on to this day, as we'll talk about. Michael Isikoff is joining us today to talk about the U.S. government's war on gays. His documentary film is called Uniquely Nasty, The U.S. Government's War on Gays, and we have a link to all of this on our website, radiowest.org. Michael Isikoff is joining us from Washington, D.C., where he's based. Well, one of the most explosive stories, as I mentioned in the film, is the story of Lester C. Hunt. Let's explain who he was. A popular Democratic governor of Wyoming formerly, and elected to the Senate in 1948, I think it was.
Yes, and I was popular in Wyoming, not a showboat, not widely known, but he was a critic of Joe McCarthy.
Right.
He served with McCarthy in the Senate. He was there as the McCarthy witch hunts unfolded. And Lester Hunt was reasonably outspoken criticizing McCarthy. And as a result, he paid a really fearsome price.
You were able to find his son, 86, 87 now?
88, now 87 years old.
Wow.
Lester Hunt Jr.
Yeah.
And it is a amazing story that, frankly, until I got into this, I didn't know. I'm a fairly knowledgeable guy about Washington politics and history. And when I learned the story of Lester Hunt and his son, it literally floored me. Lester Hunt Jr., as a young man, while his father was in the Senate in 1953, goes to Lafayette Park across the street from the White House one night.
Right.
At the time, this was a place where Washington cops, part of what was known then as the Pervert Elimination Squad, were lurking and basically undercover there to arrest gay males. Lester Hunt Jr. makes a pass at an undercover police officer and gets arrested on morals charges. He's fingerprinted. He's booked.
And that would have been the end of it almost.
Right, right. Yeah. In fact, the Washington police chose not to pursue the case. It was a first-time offense. He was a theology student. For whatever reason, they didn't think it was all that serious. But two of Joe McCarthy's allies, Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire and Herman Welker of Idaho, learn about the arrest of Senator Hunt's son. And they intervene in the case. They summon the head of the D.C. Vice Squad to Capitol Hill to answer questions about his handling of the case. They suggest he must have taken some sort of bribe to let the senator's son off, and they demand that he be prosecuted. And as a result of this pressure, Lester Hunt Jr. is taken to trial and convicted. His father sits next to him during the trial. He's distraught. He pays a $100 fine. It was a low moment for the Hunt family,
right.
And it turned out to be a low moment in American politics because those two senators didn't stop there. They then ratcheted up the pressure on Senator Hunt. At the time, the two parties were evenly divided. Mm-hmm. Control of the Senate was up for grabs. This was 1954. It was going to be election year. And they basically blackmailed Senator Hunt. They let him know that if he were to run for reelection, they would flood the state of Wyoming with 25,000 pamphlets telling every voter in the state about what had happened to his son, the gay, the arrest for soliciting gay sex. And this devastated Senator Hunt. He goes to his office on a Saturday morning with a rifle and kills himself.
How did that story play out? It's interesting because in many ways it was, as you report in the film, it's pretty much covered up. I mean, there was the way it was reported was that Senator Hunt was distraught because of some illness issues and that he ended his life as because he didn't want to die a horrible death or something
right.
like now, that.
Actually, in some ways, this is the most consequential political story of the era you've never heard of.
Right.
It was covered up at the time. The Hunt family didn't want to discuss it.
Sure.
The official story was the senator was suffering from ill health. That's what was put out publicly. A Washington columnist, Drew Pearson,
right.
did write about the blackmail, but that was adamantly denied. There was an effort to discredit Drew Pearson, and the story sort of went away. But it caught the imagination of a Washington reporter, Alan Drury, who wrote this blockbuster novel in 1959, mm-hmm. Advise and Consent, in which a senator from Utah, actually,
right.
is blackmailed over a homosexual affair in his past during World War II and then goes to his office and kills himself. That's made into a popular Hollywood movie in 1962 by Otto Preminger, starring Henry Fonda, Charles Lawton,
yeah.
Peter Lawford, and it's actually one of my favorite Washington movies because it's really sort of centered around a confirmation battle that's sort of loosely based on the Alger Hiss Whitaker Chambers story, and then the whole gay thing comes at you from left field,
yeah.
and really stuns you. It's a stunning moment. But I had no idea. I probably have seen that movie 6 or 7 times, and I had no idea it was based on this real story of Senator Lester Hunt. And as we show in the film, that the book and the movie had real consequences for gays who were in politics and still in the closet.
Yeah, well, let me play a clip actually from this moment, because as you talk about in the film, this book and then this Hollywood film really, as you put it, scars a generation of those in politics who were still in the closet. And among those, of course, was Barney Frank. Charles Francis, too, was involved in politics. Here's another moment from Michael Isikoff's documentary.
I was at that time a gay man who knew I was gay, who was interested in politics, who was so intimidated by the unanimous prevailing contempt for gay people that I didn't think I would ever be able to tell anybody. And if I ever had any doubt about it, reading this book, I really drove it home.
You can ask any gay man who's sort of my age, what did you think when you first saw Advise and Consent? It's almost too much.
I needed money, Rick.
You as the gay man are treated as subversive, potentially treasonous, insane, and damned.
It's amazing the impact that film and that book had on Barney Frank and Charles Francis. I mean, this sense of shame really
yeah.
comes through in your reporting,
and,
I think.
And we show some of the clips from that movie in the film, and they are really stunning to watch. I mean, the as Charles Francis says, the depiction of gays, it's almost sort of lurid. There's this memorable scene inside a gay bar in which the senator from Utah is trying to track down the ex-lover who's being used to blackmail him, and he's just horrified when he walks into the gay bar and sees him and sees the scene. You captured some of it by hearing it, but it in some ways you've got to watch it. You got to see it. You've got to see it because it can blow you away.
Yeah. I want to play a moment to back up just a bit because you interview a former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson, who's great. As always, I have to say,
yes.
And him reacting here to the really dastardly tactics by Senator Bridges, Senator Welker of Idaho, to try to blackmail Senator Hunt. So we'll hear Alan Simpson here. He's pretty frank, as he always is. You'll also hear, by the way, Lester Hunt Jr., who has his own particular opinions about those two senators and about that type of those type of tactics. Here's another moment from the documentary, Uniquely Nasty, the U.S. Government's War on Gays.
That just passes all bounds of decency. That is absolutely beyond the pale of politics. It's just a couple of sons of bitches doing evil things like out of Macbeth.
I think they were assholes. I mean, bastards. I mean, you know, it's the kind of political activity you just don't engage in.
I guess you expected that of Alan Simpson to be anything but frank. You would probably not expect.
Right. He is, as always, a great interview. I should point out, we actually just posted a little postscript to this today on our website. Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin.
Isn't this ironic?
Yes. She is the first openly lesbian member of the United States Congress. And she also happens to hold Joe McCarthy's old seat in Wisconsin. And she saw some of Uniquely Nasty, and she wrote a letter just last week to the Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch, asking her to open up the files and reinvestigate the suicide of Lester Hunt. She said, you know, history demands this, that, you know, this was a really serious abuse that captures the homophobia and bigotry of the time. Now, of course, Stiles Bridges and Herman Welker and Joe McCarthy are all dead. So I don't think she or anybody else expects there would be criminal prosecutions out of this. But she does want the historical record set straight and the government's files on this to be opened. And as Charles Francis says in the piece, and we wrote a piece which we posted on Yahoo News today, this is Emmett Till territory.
Right.
Emmett Till, of course, being the teenager who was murdered in Mississippi, the African-American teenager murdered in Mississippi, and, you know, one of the signature civil rights cases of the era, and was reinvestigated by the Justice Department after civil rights groups and members of Congress demanded that in recent years. So there's a, you know, whether what the Justice Department does, I don't know, but, but you know, there is the sort of the demands of history here.
I don't want to spend a lot of time with this because you don't really make any reference to this in the film, but I think it's going to come up for some people. Another irony, J. Edgar Hoover's persecuting gay people, because we don't know exactly his inclinations. We do know that he had a longtime male partner, and there was always talk about the fact that he may have also have been gay. What can you say about that part? Because you don't include this in
the
film.
Well, we didn't include it in the film, although in one of the pieces that accompanies the film, we do discuss that at some length. Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover lived was a lifelong bachelor, and his closest companion in life was his longtime deputy, Clyde Tolson, another lifelong bachelor. They ate lunch together every day. They went on vacations together. They're buried in adjoining plots at Congressional Cemetery. In many ways, as Charles Francis said in one conversation I had with him, their relationship was spousal. Now, what happened behind closed doors between Hoover and Tolson, nobody knows. There is no historical record to draw definitive conclusions about that. But it is interesting. There were certainly rumors about Hoover throughout this era, and whenever one of them would reach Hoover's desk, and there are documents about this, which we do write about in the in one of the links in the piece on Hoover that accompanies Uniquely Nasty. Whenever Hoover would hear that somebody was spreading these rumors, in one case a federal employee is overheard saying, "Did you know the director was a queer?" He orders a full-scale investigation by FBI agents in which they effectively intimidate the employee and warn him never to repeat such malicious slander again.
There are a couple of more characters I want to get to before we run out of time. Let's talk about Charlie Baker and his sort of his legal champion, Frank. Is it Kameny?
Kameny.
Kameny,
yes,
yeah.
Yes,
these are two great characters. Tell this story, the story of Charlie Baker.
Charlie Baker, yes. I alluded to this before, but, you know, we take the story forward into the 60s and 70s. It wasn't just the McCarthy era. And as I mentioned, you know, the federal policy on gays morphed and expanded during this era so that all gays were banned from any federal job. And we found this guy, Charlie Baker, who was in the Navy, actually got kicked out of the Navy because you couldn't be gay and be serving the U.S. military in the time.
And he was openly gay for the time, which
he was openly gay.
That was
and he gets this right,
yeah.
And he gets this low-level clerk typist job, the National Bureau of Standards. And suddenly one day he gets a letter in the mail from the government saying, "We have found, because they got a hold of his military files, that you have engaged in, and we're quite the letter is quite explicit about the sorts of homosexual activity that he and some of his partners had engaged to, and as a result, you must find grounds for why you should not be fired." Right. Effectively, he was fired, and he was devastated. I mean, he couldn't believe that his private sex conduct, which had absolutely nothing to do with his job, was going to leave him in the ranks of the unemployed. And he fought back, though. And that's what's interesting about his story. He's one of the first and earliest to fight back. He reaches out to Frank Kameny, who was then the sort of preeminent gay civil rights activist in the country. Frank Kameny himself had been fired for he was an astronomer,
right.
Worked for the Federal Mapping Agency, and he was fired because he was gay, an astronomer. And Frank Kameny took up his case, wrote letter after letter to the Civil Service Commission, encouraged Charlie Baker to file a lawsuit, and lo and behold, in 1973,
yep.
A federal judge rules in Charlie Baker's favor and concludes that unless the government could show some nexus, some connection between the same-sex conduct and Charlie Baker's job performance, he is entitled to keep his job and to be paid retroactively. It's one of the first civil rights victories for gays.
Don't we know about that? Why does no one know about that?
That's amazing. It was not reported at the time. This wasn't a news story in 1973. It got no attention. And that's one of the sort of amazing things,
yeah.
That until Charles Francis, in his sort of search for the history of the persecution of gays, stumbles across Charlie Baker's story in old government files, it had been forgotten. And Charlie Baker was thrilled when he learns about what Charles Francis is doing. They reconnect, and I track him down. And as luck would have it, while we were making this movie, Charlie Baker, last April, is getting married to his partner of more than 30 years on a beach in Florida,
yeah.
With another couple, a straight couple, and they allowed us to film the wedding. And it's kind of a touching scene,
yeah, it's
to
nice.
See this guy who was once fired and excoriated for his sexual preferences now is allowed to get married to the love of his life.
Let me ask you this finally, Michael Isikoff. Charles Francis reveals to you, talks to you about, finding thousands and thousands of cases of federal workers who were targeted, and as he puts it, animus embedded in the federal government. And this idea of animus is interesting how it plays out today in the same-sex marriage case that played out in the Supreme Court. Would you sort of wrap this up with that part of how that is,
sure,
relevant,
yeah.
Today?
Yeah, and I mean there was an amicus brief filed in the same-sex marriage case before the Supreme Court, making that point that that same-sex marriage bans were rooted in this historical animus and therefore discriminatory. And there is a passage in Justice Kennedy's decision where he talks about the historical discrimination of gays, and it's a part of the mix. It's a part of the of this amazing social transformation which we've had. I'd just like to close on one one small quick point if I can.
Sure.
In 1945, the historian Arthur Schlesinger wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Andrew Jackson that makes no mention at all of Indian removal. The whole Trail of Tears, persecution of Native Americans, expulsion from their territory was erased from the history of the time. In many ways, I see this story that we tell in Uniquely Nasty about the discrimination and persecution and targeting of gays as an example of that. It's a deleted passage of our history, and I hope this film makes a sort of modest contribution to restoring that and eliminating that erasure.
Michael Isikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News. You can find links to the documentary Uniquely Nasty and his reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We're showcasing the documentary in our section in Video West. You can see that on videowest.org as well. Michael Isikoff joined us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Michael, thank you very much for the time.
Hey, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.